The speeches were mercifully short and inconsequential. A brief welcome from Favut and a short appreciation from Macmillan, and the conversation at Shah's end of the table never rose above such earth-shaking subjects as their recent defeat by the Argentinians on the polo field, Dennis Compton's batting form, and Stirling Moss's latest victory in the Mille Miglia. But as soon as the banquet ended, Shahzer sought out Littleton, who was still with Tara, drawing out the pleasure of her company to the last. "Looking forward to tomorrow," he told Littleton casually. "I hear your Supermac is going to give us some fireworks." "Wherever did you hear that?" Littleton asked. But Shahzer saw the sudden shift of his gaze and the guarded expression that froze his smile. "Can we have a word?" Shahzer asked quietly, and apologized to Tara. "Excuse me, my dear." He took Littleton's elbow, and chatting amicably, steered him through the glass doors onto the paved stoop under the trellised vines. "What is going on, Peter?" he lowered his voice. "Isn't there anything you can tell me?" Their relationship was intimate and of long standing. Such a direct appeal could not be ignored. "I'll be frank with you, Shahzer," Littleton said. "Mac has something up his sleeve. I don't know what it is, but he is planning on creating a sensation. The press at home have been put on the alert. It's going to be a major policy statement. That is my best guess." "Will it alter things between us? Preferential trade, for instance?" Shahzer demanded. "Trade?" Littleton chuckled. "Of course not. Nothing alters trade. More than that, I can't tell you. We'll all have to wait for tomorrow." Neither Tara nor Shahzer spoke on the drive back to Veltefrieden until the rolls passed beneath the Unreath gateway, and then Tara asked, her voice strained and jerky, "What time is Macmillan making his speech tomorrow?" "The special session will begin at 11 o'clock," Shahzer replied, but he was still thinking of what Littleton had told him. "I wanted to be in the visitors' gallery. I asked Tricia to get me a ticket." "Oh, the session isn't being held in the chamber. Not enough seating. It'll be in the dining room, and I don't think they'll allow visitors." He broke off and stared at her. In the reflected light of the headlamps, she had gone deathly pale. "What is it, Tara?" "The dining room," she breathed. "Are you sure?" "Of course I am. Is something wrong, my dear?" "Yes, no, nothing's wrong. It's just a little heartburn, the dinner." "Pretty awful," he agreed, and returned his attention to the road. "The dining room," she thought in near panic. "I have to warn Moses. I have to warn him it cannot be tomorrow. All his arrangements will have to be made for the escape. I have to let him know." Shahzer dropped her at the front doors of the chateau and took the rolls down to the garages. When he came back, she was in the blue drawing room, and the servants, who had as usual waited up for their return, was serving hot chocolate and biscuits. Shahzer's valet helped him change into a maroon velvet smoking jacket, and the housemaids hovered anxiously until Shahzer dismissed them. Tara had always opposed this custom. "I could easily warm up the milk myself, and you could put on a jacket without having another grown man to help you," she complained, when the servants had left the room. "It's feudal and cruel to keep them up until all hours." "Nonsense, my dear." Shahzer poured himself a cognac to go with his chocolate. "It's a tradition that they value as much as we do. Makes them feel indispensable and part of the family. Besides, Chef would have a seizure if you were to mess up his kitchen." Then he slumped into his favourite armchair and became unusually serious. He began to talk to her, as he had at the beginning of their marriage, when they had still been in accord. "There's something afoot that I don't like. Here we stand at the opening of a new decade, the 1960s. We've had nearly 12 years of nationalist rule, and none of my direst predictions have come to pass. But I feel a sense of unease. I have the feeling that our tide has been at full flood. But the turn is coming. I think that tomorrow may be the day when the ebb sets in." He broke off and grinned shamefacedly. "Forgive me. As you know, I don't usually indulge in fantasy," he said, and sipped his chocolate and his cognac in silence. Tara felt not the least sympathy for him. There was so much she wanted to say, so many recriminations to lay upon him, but she could not trust herself to speak. Once she began, she might lose control and divulge too much. She might not be able to prevent herself gloating on the dreadful retribution that had awaited him and all those like him. And she did not want to prolong this tete-a-tete. She wanted to be free to go to Moses, to warn him that today was not the day he had planned for. So she rose. You know how I feel. We don't have to discuss it. I'm going to bed. Excuse me. Yes, of course. He stood up courteously. I'll be working for the next few hours. I have to go over my notes for my meeting with Littleton and his team tomorrow afternoon. So don't worry about me. Tara checked that Isabella was in her room and asleep before she went to her suite and locked the door. She changed out of her long dress and jewellery into jeans and a dark sweater. Then she made a cannabis cigarette, and while she smoked it, she waited 15 minutes by her watch for Shaza to settle down to his work. Then she switched off her lights. She dropped the cigarette butt into the toilet and flushed it away. Before she let herself into the passage once again, locking her suite against the unlikely chance that Shaza might come up to look for her. Then she went down the back stairs. As she crossed the wide stoop, keeping against the wall, staying in the shadows and moving silently, a telephone rang in the library wing, and she froze involuntarily, her heart jarring her ribs. Then she realized that the telephone must be Shaza's private line, and she was about to move on when she heard his voice. Although the curtains were drawn, the windows of his study were open, and she could see the shadow of his head against the drapes. "Kitty," he said. "Kitty Godolphin, you little witch. I should have guessed that you'd be here." The name startled Tara and brought back harrowing memories, but she could not resist the temptation to creep closer to the curtained window. "You always follow the smell of blood, don't you?" Shaza said, and chuckled at her reply. "Where are you, the Nelly?" The Mount Nelson was simply the best hotel in Cape Town. "Oh, and what are you doing now? I mean, right this moment." "Yes, I know it's 2 o'clock in the morning, but any time is a good time. You told me that yourself a long time ago. It'll take me half an hour to get there. Whatever else you do, don't start without me." He hung up, and she saw his shadow on the curtain as he stood up from his desk. She ran to the end of the long stoop and jumped down into the hydrangea bed and crouched in the bushes. Within a few minutes, Shaza came out of the side door. He had a dark overcoat over his smoking jacket. He went down to the garages and drove away in the Jaguar. Even in his haste, he drove slowly through the vineyards so as not to blow dust on his precious grapes. And watching the headlights disappear, Tara hated him as much as she ever had. She thought that she should have grown accustomed to his philandering, but he was like a tomcat in rut. No woman was safe from him, and his moral outrage against Sean, his own son, for the same behaviour had been ludicrous. Kitty Godolphin. She cast her mind back to their first meeting and the television reporter's reaction to the mention of Shaza's name, and now the reason for it became clear. "Oh, God, I hate him so. He is totally without conscience or pity. He deserves to die." She said it aloud and then clapped her hand over her mouth. "I shouldn't have said it, but it's true. He deserves to die, and I deserve to be free of him. Free to go to Moses and my child." She rose out of the hydrangea bushes, brushed the clinging soil from her jeans, and crossed the lawns quickly. The moon was in its first quarter, but bright enough to throw her shadow in front of her, and she entered the vineyard with relief and hurried down the rows of vines that were heavy with leaf and grape. She skirted the winery and the stables and reached the servants' cottages. She had placed Moses in the room at the end of the second row of cottages, and his window faced out onto the vineyard. She tapped on his window, and his response was almost immediate. She knew he slept as lightly as a wildcat. "It's me," she whispered. "Wait," he said. "I will open the door." He loomed in the doorway, naked except for a pair of white shorts, and his body shone in the moonlight like wet tar. "You are foolish to come here," he said, and taking her arm, drew her into the single room. "You are putting everything at risk. Moses, please listen to me. I had to tell you. It cannot be tomorrow." He stared at her contemptuously. "You were never a true daughter of the revolution." "No, no, 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 I am true, and I love you enough to do anything. But they have changed the arrangements. They will not use the chamber where you have set the charge. They will meet in the parliamentary dining room." He stared at her a second longer. Then he turned and went to the narrow built-in cupboard at the head of his bed and began to dress in his uniform. "What are you going to do?" she asked. "I have to warn the others. They also are in danger." "What others?" she asked. "I did not know there were others." "You know only what you have to know," he told her curtly. "I must use the Chev. Is it safe?" "Yes, Charles is not here. He's gone out. Can I come with you?" "Are you mad?" he asked. "If the police find a black man and a white woman together at this time of night..." He did not finish the sentence. "You must go back to the house and make a phone call. Here is the number. A woman will answer, and you will say only, 'Cheetah is coming. He will be there in 30 minutes. That is all you will say, and then you will hang up." Moses threaded the Chev through the maze of narrow streets of District 6, the old Malay quarter. During the day, this was a colourful and thriving community of small stores and businesses. General dealers and tailors and tinsmiths and halal butcheries occupied the ground-floor shops of the decrepit Victorian buildings, while from the cast-iron fretwork of the open balconies above hung a festival of drying laundry, and the convoluted streets were clamorous with the cries of street vendors, the mournful horns of itinerant fishmongers, and the laughter of children. At nightfall, the traders shuttered their premises and left the streets to the street gangs and the pimps and the prostitutes. Some of the most daring white revellers came here late at night to listen to the jazz players in the crowded shebeens, or to look for a pretty coloured girl, more for the thrill of danger and discovery than for any physical gratification. Moses parked the Chev in a dark side street. On the wall were the graffiti that declared that this territory of the Rude Boys, one of the most notorious of the street gangs, and he waited only a few seconds before the first gang member materialised out of the shadows, an urchin with the body of a child and the face of a vicious old man. "Look after it well," Moses flipped him a silver shilling. "If the tyres are slashed when I come back, I'll do the same for your backside." The child grinned at him evilly. He climbed the dark and narrow staircase to the Vortex Club. A couple on the landing were copulating furtively, but furiously, against the wall as Moses squeezed past. The white man turned his face away, but he never missed a beat. At the door to the club, somebody studied him briefly, through the peephole, and then let him enter. The long, crowded room was hazy with tobacco smoke and the sweet smell of cannabis. The clientele included the full spectrum, from gang members in zoot suits and wide ties to white men in dinner jackets. Only the women were all coloured. Dollar Brand and his quartet were playing a sweet, soulful jazz, and everybody was still and attentive. Nobody even looked up as Moses slipped down the side wall to the door at the far end, but the man guarding it recognised Moses and stood aside for him to enter. In the back room there was only one man sitting at a round gambling table under a green-shaded light. There was a cigarette smouldering between his fingers, and his face was pale as putty, his eyes implacable dark pits. "You are foolhardy to call a meeting now," said Joe Cicero, "without good reason. All the preparations have been made. There is nothing more to discuss." "I have good reason," said Moses, and sat down on the empty chair facing him across the baize-covered table. Joe Cicero listened without expression, but when Moses finished, he pushed the lank hair off his forehead with the back of his hand. Moses had learned to interpret that gesture as one of agitation. "We cannot dismantle the escape route and then set it up again later. These things take time to arrange. The aircraft is already in position." It was an Aztec, chartered from a company in Johannesburg, and the pilot was a lecturer in political philosophy at Witwatersrand University, the holder of a private pilot's license, and a secret member of the South African Communist Party. "How long can he wait at the rendezvous?" Moses asked, and Cicero thought about it a moment. "A week at the longest," he replied. The rendezvous was an unregistered airstrip on a large, drought-stricken ranch in Namaqualand, which was lying derelict, abandoned by the discouraged owner. From the airfield, it was a 4-hour flight to Bechuanaland, the British protectorate that lay against the northwestern border of the Union of South Africa. Sanctuary had been arranged for Moses there, the beginning of the pipeline by which most political fugitives were channeled to the north. "A week must be enough," Moses said. "Every hour increases the danger. At the first occasion that we can be sure Favut will take his seat again, I will do it." It was 4 o'clock in the morning before Moses left the Vortex Club and went down to where he had parked the Chev. Kitty Godolphin sat in the centre of the bed, naked and cross-legged with all the shameless candour of a child. In the years Shaza had known her, she had changed very little physically. Her body had matured slightly, her breasts had more weight to them, and the tips had darkened. He could no longer make out the rack of her ribs beneath the smooth, pale skin. But her buttocks were still lean as a boy's, and her limbs coltishly long and slim. Nor had she lost the air of guileless innocence, that aura of eternal youth which so contrasted with the cynical hardness of her gaze. She was telling him about the Congo. She had been there for the last 5 months, and the material she had filmed would surely put her in line for her third Emmy and confirm her position as the most successful television journalist on the American networks. She was speaking in the breathless voice of an ingenue. "They caught these three Simba agents and tried them under the mango trees outside the burned-out hospital. But by the time they had sentenced them to death, the light was too bad for filming. I gave the commander my Rolex watch, and in turn he postponed the executions until the sun was up the next morning so that Hank could film. It was the most incredible footage. The next morning they paraded the condemned men naked through the marketplace, and the local women bargained for the various parts of their bodies. The Baluba have always been cannibals. When they had sold all three of them, they took them down to the river and shot them, in the head, of course, so as not to damage the meat, and they butchered them there on the river bank, and the women queued up to claim their portions." She was trying to shock him, and it irritated Shaza that she had succeeded. "Where do you stand, my love?" he asked bitterly. "One day you are sympathetically interviewing Martin Luther King, and the next you are portraying all the grossest savagery of Africa." She laughed, that throaty chuckle that always roused him. "And the very next day I am recording the British imperialist making bargains with your gang of bully boys, while you stand with a foot on the neck of your slaves." "Damn it, Kitty. What are you? What are you trying to do?" "Capture reality," she told him simply. "And when reality doesn't conform your view of it, you bribe somebody with a Rolex watch to alter it?" "I've made you mad," she laughed delightedly, and he stood up from the bed and crossed to where he had thrown his clothes over the back of the chair. "You look like a little boy when you sulk," she called after him. "It'll be light in an hour. I have to get back home and change," he said. "I've got an appointment with my imperialist slave masters at 11. "Of course, you've got to be there to hear Supermac tell you how much he wants to buy your golds and diamonds. And he doesn't care whether you're dripping with the sweat and blah." "All right, sweetness," he cut her off. "That's enough for one night." He stepped into his trousers, and as he tucked in his shirt, he grinned at her. "Why do I always pick screaming radical females?" "You like the stimulation," she suggested. But he shook his head and reached for the velvet smoking jacket. "I prefer the loving. Talking of which, when will I see you again?" "Why, at 11 o'clock at the Houses of Parliament, of course. I'll try to get you in the shot. You are so photogenic, darling." He went to the bed and stooped over her to kiss that angelic smile on her lips. "I can never understand what I see in you," he said. He was still thinking of her as he went down to the hotel car park and wiped the dew off the windshield of the Jaguar. It was amazing how she had been able so effortlessly to hold his interest over all these years. No other woman except Tara had ever done that. It was silly how good he felt when he had been with her. She could still drive him wild with erotic desire. Her tricks still worked on him. And afterwards he felt elated and wonderfully alive. And, yes, he enjoyed arguing with her. "God, I haven't closed my eyes all night, yet I feel like a derby winner. I wonder if I'm still in love with the little bitch."